So DNA fingerprinting is called fingerprinting, of course, because it's analogous to true fingerprinting, which is a way to identify people, right? It has nothing to do with a fingerprint, but the DNA of your body is like a fingerprint because it is unique. No one else has your exact DNA. So it's why it's a really good way of telling the identity of someone. Now, DNA is what kind of macromolecule? What are the four kinds of macromolecules in organisms?
Proteins,
lipids,
carbohydrates,
polysaccharides, which are carbohydrates, nucleic acids. Right, DNA, that's what the NA of DNA stands for, nucleic acid. So DNA, remember, means, or it does mean deoxyribonucleic acid. RNA is also a nucleic acid, it's ribonucleic acid. But DNA is what we're using today. And have you talked about DNA at all yet in lecture? You haven't much? Okay, well, you probably already know from just the popular press that a DNA molecule is a double helix. A helix is just a corkscrew shape. That's a single helix. A DNA is a double helix because it's made up of two pieces that are connected together. Each one is like a half ladder. When you have the two combined here, notice this looks like a ladder. Well, this isn't in helical form. It's been untwisted. But when it naturally occurs, you would take this ladder-shaped thing and twist it. So that forms one helix for one half of the ladder and one helix for the other. All right? The overall structure of DNA, well, DNA is an example of a polymer. Three of those macromolecules that living things are made out of are polymers. The one that isn't is lipids. They're still big molecules, which is why they're macromolecules, but they're not officially polymers. Polymers are things that are made by stringing together a bunch of subunits, which are monomers. Monomer means one part, polymer means many parts. And that's how you build polysaccharides, proteins, and nucleic acids, by stringing together subunits. But the three are different from each other because they're made of different kinds of subunits. And you might already know what the subunits of proteins are. What are they? Amino acids, right. So you make a protein by stringing together amino acids. That's a polymer. You make a polysaccharide by stringing together what monomers, what subunits. They are sugars, but so are the...
Glucose
is an example of a subunit. Monosaccharides, right? Simple sugars are the subunits that, when you string them together, make up complex sugars or polysaccharides. Well, for DNA and RNA, the subunits or the monomers are called what? Does anyone know? No? Not quite. The monomers of nucleic acids are called nucleotides. Okay? Here's the word nucleotide. Now let's look at this piece of DNA right here. Like I said, it's double-stranded. But each strand, which would be just the left half of this, is one strand. So all this is one strand. Each strand is itself a polymer. Each strand is a polynucleotide because it's many nucleotides strung together, end to end. Every individual nucleotide has three parts to it. So let me circle one nucleotide here. This bottom left right here, the A, the S, and the P, those three together is one nucleotide. And so that shows you the three parts that every nucleotide has. Every nucleotide has a sugar, It's called a pentose sugar because there's five carbons in it, which is why it's depicted with the pentagram, pentagon. For DNA, that sugar is the same in every nucleotide within the DNA. And that sugar is deoxyribose. Remember, sugars end in O-S-E. Deoxyribose is just the name of the sugar that is part of every one of these nucleotides. So this S is identical in every one of these. The second part of it, of a nucleotide, is a phosphate, which is denoted by the P. The phosphate is stuck onto the sugar. And every phosphate is identical as well. So this P is the same in all cases. The third part of a nucleotide is the only part that varies from one nucleotide to the next. But whichever version it is, it's called a nitrogenous base. And nitrogenous simply means containing nitrogen. In living things, in DNA, there's four possible nitrogenous bases that can be used, which are abbreviated as A, C, T, and G, which is why they named the Gattaca movie Gattaca. It's a combination of those letters. G stands for guanine, C stands for cytosine, A stands for adenosine, and T stands for thymine. Those are the four different kinds of nitrogenous bases. So just because there are different nitrogenous bases is the only reason why there are different kinds of nucleotides within DNA. And when you string together these nucleotides to form the overall strand, it's like making a necklace out of four different kinds of beads, and you get to pick whatever kind of bead you want for every position on the necklace. All right? That's what makes up this one strand. And then the other strand is made similarly. But here's the special thing about DNA. The two strands are held together only by interactions between their nitrogenous bases. Notice that the sugar and the phosphate on this one strand don't interact with the sugar or the phosphate with the other strand. It's only the nitrogenous bases of the two strands that come together. And by the way, that sugar and phosphate, the sugar part and the phosphate, are what make it a long strand. That's what actually binds together the individual nucleotides within a strand. Notice, you can see that right here. This A, S, and P, that is the first nucleotide. This C, S, and P is the next one in line, right? Well, what joins this nucleotide to this nucleotide is a bond between the phosphate of this nucleotide and the sugar of this next nucleotide. And then the same thing's happening here. So it keeps going back and forth. Sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, all the way down the line. That's what gives it its linear integrity. That's what holds it together as one long strand. And that's why it's called the sugar phosphate backbone. This one has its own sugar phosphate backbone. And that's why, and those are made of covalent bonds, these bonds between sugar and phosphate. Those are covalent chemical bonds, which are strong bonds, so it makes it hard to pull the thing apart along its length. But holding these two strands together, side by side, are really weak bonds between these nitrogenous bases. Those are hydrogen bonds, which are a lot weaker than a covalent bond, and so it can really easily be pulled apart. That's for an individual one. But the reason that holds the two strands hold together pretty well under normal circumstances is because you have a shitload of nucleotides. So a very many times not very much strength means overall a lot of strength. Okay? It's nice, though, that they are easily broken because DNA can't operate unless you, at times, unzip it, separate the two strands from each other. That's how it's used. Well, notice the arrangement of these nitrogenous bases. A here is pairing with T. This other A is pairing with T. This A on the other strand is pairing with T. It's always A with T and T with A. Similarly, it's C always with G or G always with C. Right, I mean, I'm talking about under normal circumstances. And so this is called complementarity. In other words, adenine A is complementary to thymine T. So they always, wherever you find A in one strand, at the same spot on the other strand, you'll always find T. And C with G. That's really important. This is how DNA works. DNA has two major jobs. Its one job is to be able to copy itself for the next generation, for the next cell, so that cell has the same exact DNA that the original cell did. Its other job is to stand as a code for how to make the proteins of the body, which is why it gives you your traits. But the reason it's able to copy itself is because if you imagine taking one of these strands away, you don't have to look at what that sequence is. You can tell what it has to be based on what the sequence is of the other one that's remaining. So since this one is A, C, A, T, G, without even looking at this one, you can tell it has to be T, G, T, A, C, bottom to top. And similarly, if you remove this one, you could tell what it is based on this one. So that's how DNA replicates itself. The two separate, and then they form, each one forms a new strand complementary to itself. And that ends up making two double strands that are identical to each other. All right? Now, this is a tiny, tiny fraction of the overall length of a DNA molecule. A single DNA molecule is not only a polymer, it is a long polymer made up of literally millions of nucleotides in one long strand. And if you imagine making a necklace that's millions of beads long, even though you only have four choices of beads each position, if you do the math, that is effectively an unlimited number of possibilities, which is why the same person doesn't occur twice just by chance, only by twins, in which case they really have the same DNA, and only for identical twins. So this is just a tiny fraction of the length. Well, that's how DNA is made, by these bases. So every individual DNA molecule will have a certain sequence. That's what we talk about when we say the DNA sequence. That's just the particular sequence of nitrogenous bases that are in that particular DNA molecule. And so that is your fingerprint, your DNA fingerprint. It's your sequence of DNA. All right? Now, the DNA fingerprinting technique relies on being able to compare one DNA piece sample from some person to another DNA sample. So what you're doing tonight is a technique to basically on a suspect by suspect basis, for each individual suspect, that is, you answer the yes-no question: is this suspect's DNA the same as the DNA that's in the crime scene? So, doing that requires the help of some special enzymes that we first learned about when we found them in bacteria. And these enzymes are called restriction endonucleases. Things that end in A-S-E are enzymes. Now, the word nuclease gets its name from the fact that it's an enzyme that can break a nucleic acid into smaller pieces. So it cuts that necklace somewhere along the length. If it cuts it just once, then a single piece of DNA will now be two smaller pieces of DNA. If it cuts it twice, it'll be three, and so on. Endo means within. So an endonuclease is an enzyme that cuts DNA somewhere in the middle of the strand, not at It doesn't just take one nucleotide off the end, in other words. That would be an exonuclease. So it cuts it somewhere in the middle of the strand. Not perfectly in the middle, but somewhere in the interior. Well, the reason that bacteria have these things is to protect themselves from viral attacks. A virus isn't an organism. All it can do is inject its own DNA into the bacteria, fooling the bacteria into reproducing that viral DNA instead of the bacterial DNA. That's how new viruses are made. Bacteria make them for, or cells make them for the virus. Obviously, that's bad for the cell, the bacterium in this case. So bacteria evolved these enzymes as a way of chopping up DNA that the viral DNA so that they could be not harmed by the viruses. To do that, they had to protect their own DNA, because these endonucleases would be dangerous things to have around your own DNA, right? So they do that by methylating or adding methyl groups onto their own DNA to protect them. And anything that's non-methylated, which would be the viral DNA that's coming into the cell, gets snipped into little bits. Well, these endonucleases recognize a certain miniature sequence of nucleotides within an overall long DNA strand. So let's just say, for example, that you would have CTAAC as part of your sequence. That it goes on and on both ends. This is just somewhere in the middle of the DNA strand. The other strand, by the way, you could tell would have to be what? GATTG. So, let's say, for example, there's different kinds of restriction endonucleases, but each one recognizes a certain small sequence. So let's say it recognizes this right here. What I'm drawing here is where it would cut this. If it has this CTAAC sequence and it recognizes it, it would cut one strand right there and the other strand right there. Both of them right after the T. Right? And so now what was a long piece of DNA is two pieces of smaller DNA. The sequence hasn't been scrambled. It's just the overall sequence has been cut into two smaller lengths. Everyone with me on that? So restriction endonucleases will cut any given DNA strand into a different total number of small pieces depending on how many of these sequences are in that original DNA. Because that same enzyme will recognize every instance of that sequence. If that same sequence occurs 100,000 base pairs down the line, it's going to snip it there too. Right? So these things are called recognition sites. And however many recognition sites are in your overall sample of DNA, your original one strand, that's how many snips are going to be made by that enzyme, and therefore that's going to determine how many pieces you end up with. Also, though, let's just say you have two samples, two different people's samples, and they're not identical, so they have different sequences, but let's just say, for the sake of simplicity, that each one has one recognition site. Each one has this somewhere in it, but the two different people have them in different positions. So let's say this is the one person's DNA and that recognition site is right there. The other person's DNA has it right there. Okay? When the endonuclease recognizes the recognition sites, it's going to cleave it there. Well, that's going to leave this one, this small piece, and this bigger piece. This one's going to have two pieces that differ from both of the sizes of these. And that's the basis that we're using to determine that these tooth samples are different. Because electrophoresis is a way of separating little pieces of DNA and particles in general. You can use electrophoresis for more than just DNA, but in tonight's case, it's DNA. Separating them on the basis of charge and size. All right? Now, the reason that you can separate it based on charge is if you have a mixture of particles, some of which are negative and some of which are positive, they're going to go opposite directions in the gel, right? Now, that's not tonight because it's all DNA tonight, which is all negatively charged, so that it doesn't work for DNA. But if you had a mixture of differently charged things, you could separate them based on charge with electrophoresis. But aside from just charge, it also separates things based on their size. And that's because a larger particle, when it gets pushed through this viscous gel, very thick gel, there's going to be more drag on a bigger particle than on a smaller particle. Okay? The force that's driving these things through these particles through the electrophoresis gel is the force of electrical attraction between opposite charges. So the DNA is being forced toward the positive pole, the positive electrode, because the DNA itself is negative. If you didn't have any charge, electrophoresis wouldn't work at all because there would be no force to push it either direction. But now, assuming that you have pieces of DNA, all of which are negatively charged, moving through this gel, it's the size differences that make them move at different speeds. Even though they're both going the same direction, two pieces of differently sized DNA are going to move through that gel. If everything else is the same, the whole gel gets the same voltage, and it's the same consistency of gel, which it is within your own one gel, and you run it for the same amount of time, then the smaller one is going to go a farther distance in that same amount of time than the larger one will, because the larger one has more drag. So what I mean by that is if I picture my gel like this with wells at the top, I'm just going to put two wells in, and let's say this is person one, this is person two. So they started out having an equal size chunk of DNA, but because the recognition site occurred at different places, the nuclease broke them into two sizes that are different from each other in the two suspects. All right? This looks like these are exactly the same length. They're not quite. I meant that this one's a little bit longer. So, suspect one, which are these two fragments that you would put with a pipette into this sample, once you stain them, which is what we're going to do after the electrophoresis, the DNA will show up as little lines, which you've seen. This is this column that this is in is called the lane. And you have little horizontal little marks with little curve in that lane. That's the DNA itself. Okay, so this one is one of these fragments. This big one. This marker represents this very long fragment. Where would the mark within that same lane for this fragment be? Farther down, right. So we'll put that right there. These things have separated. These two pieces both started out in the well. But the longer you wait, the more they separate. Because they don't change speeds. The small one stays faster by the same amount. So the longer you wait, the more they separate. If it happened to cut one piece exactly in the middle into two identically sized pieces, you would only have one marker, because both pieces would go the same exact distance. And that's why I said these aren't actually equal, even though it looks like they are. So this one, where would the lines go for suspect two? Yeah, these two that are similar in size are both smaller than the biggest one. So they would be below this, but they're both bigger than the smallest one. So they'd be both between this, and they'd be close together because they're very similar in size. So they're almost the same speed. They're running side by side almost. Just one's making a little bit of headway. That's the basis of electrophoresis. So this is not at all testing, going in there and looking at the sequence of DNA. We can do that. That's DNA sequencing. That is really an accurate DNA test. All this tells you is that the sites that the enzymes make the SNPs at in two people occur at the same place. If they match up, I'm saying. These obviously don't match up. So this tells you pretty definitively this DNA, these two samples of DNA came from different people. If they came from the same people, you'd have the same exact markers in the same positions. But what I'm trying to get across is that you could have, let me just erase it and draw it that way. You could have this situation, but that would not say that's definitely the same person. They could have different DNA, but they just happen to have the recognition sites in the same places in their DNA, and the rest of the DNA is different from each other. Okay? So they'd have the same, they would be snipped into the same sizes, but those pieces would actually be different DNA. Everyone clear on that? So obviously you wouldn't want to do just this simple a test if this were to determine whether the woman went to death row or not. I just always assume a murderer is a woman. No, actually, it's the other way around. But actually, it's a good assumption, because it usually is a man, statistically. So, this isn't a definitive test for a positive result. But that goes hand in hand with science in general, right? You don't prove things to be true, you prove things not to be true. And if they don't match, assuming no mistake was made in the test, which is why you would do it more than just once if this were life hanging in the balance. But if you consistently get a negative result, that rules out that suspect, basically. So tonight, in this mock suspects and criminal scene set up, you have how many suspects? Five? Three suspects? Five suspects in one crime scene? Okay, so the five S's, the suspects, are five different people. The crime scene is the DNA that they found at the murder site. And so maybe none of them will match. Maybe one will. If they do match, then that would be the only suspect, assuming only one does match, that would be the only suspect from that pool that you would know could possibly be guilty. The other ones would be free because their DNA doesn't match. If the size doesn't match, then certainly the sequence doesn't match. If the size does match, then you'd have to look at the sequence, which is a lot more sensitive test. It's all human DNA from whatever sample they get from a body. So humans have the same size DNA molecules, but within that length of DNA they have different nucleotide sequences, which is why we have different traits. Another thing I should say is that each of these samples that you put in the well is not just a single DNA molecule. If in preparation, you know, the stuff that you didn't do, that was done for you, there was two things that needed to be done before you could actually get to the point of pipetting them into an electrophoresis gel. One is that after you get the samples from the people, you need to have enough DNA to work with. So you put it into a machine that undergoes what is called PCR, which got famous in the OJ trial, which stands for polymerase chain reaction. That's a way of making copies of the existing DNA, just like DNA is copied in real cells. You just do that artificially in the lab, so that you make enough DNA to be able to see in your gel. But it's so each sample is one person's DNA, but it's many, many copies of the same DNA. Well, it doesn't matter how many copies you have, since they're identical copies, they'll all be snipped into the, at the same place. And so they'll all be snipped into the same number and sizes. Okay? So that needed to be done first, just getting enough of it. And then the restriction digestion was done for you as well. That's the first what the first page was all about. That's actually taking the DNA that's already been amplified and subjecting it to the enzyme itself, which snips it into the pieces. That's where they left off. That was done for you, and then you took those now digested chunks and put them into the wells. So you don't know how many pieces each sample was broken into, but you'll know how many pieces after you look at the bands in the lanes, because each band represents its own chunk of DNA. Right? Just keep in mind that you could have one band actually representing two strands if they are close enough in size, they won't have separated. But obviously, if you get three bands in one lane and two bands in another, if two of them match up, you wouldn't have two of them match up identically. That's a good point, right? You would never see this. Why is that? Right. You start out with DNA of the same size in both of them. If this one's cut in three pieces and this only in two, there's no way that these two pieces can be the same size as this, these two. But just the fact that there's different number of chunks alone tells you that person's innocent. Okay, so any questions about what you're going to, I mean, about how it operates? The only other thing I want, well, are there questions? Yeah.
Why did the smaller one move faster?
Because it has less drag on it. And if you imagine trying to drag something through a forest,
right. The
smaller it is, the easier it is. It's not going to get caught up on things nearly as easy as a big thing will. Okay, so the final step after you run these things long enough that your blue dye front is about 3/4 of the way to the end of the gel, that'll be our goal. We want them to separate enough. Then we need to stain them. And first of all, it's called stain for a reason. This stuff is really stainy. So wear gloves. Don't get it on your clothes. But also, this stuff really stains quickly. This is the stain, and notice it says reusable, which it is. Nothing goes down the drain, by the way. Anyway, whether you're reusing it or not. That's why we have the funnels and the bottles out. But I think it recommends a 2 minutes. Is it a 1 minute stain or a 2 minute stain? It's two? Okay, we're going to do maximum. Let's just make it 1 minute stain. All right? Because this stuff really does stain it. And if you get too much stain in your gel, then you have to stay here forever washing out the stain so that you can see the DNA. Because what the stain does is goes through the gel and binds to the DNA molecules, which are invisible up until the time you get some stain molecules on them. But that leaves a bunch of stain still in the gel. And the DNA, even though it's stained, won't show up against the gel because the gel is the same color. So after you stain it, you immediately need to get it in some water to stop the stain from moving into the gel more. And then you need to keep changing the water, putting fresh water in, drawing that stain out of the gel. But the stain that's on the DNA will stay on the DNA. You need to keep washing over and over using the belly dancer, which is this thing. So you have little trays. These shallow trays are for looking at your gels on the light table later. These ones, these Tupperware things, are actually their Ziploc. are for staining and washing. So you don't have to measure your stain. You when you're done with your gel, you carefully take the box out and carefully get the gel off of the little box. So it's just gel in here. Do it without breaking the gel. It's pretty easy with this thick of gel. Just pour enough stain in so that it just barely covers the thing, and swirl it for no more than 60 seconds. At 60 seconds, then immediately we need to get a funnel set up on the stain. You can put the stain back into that bottle. But with your glove on, carefully make sure that the gel doesn't flop out. Then get some water on it, and warm water will be better. And swirl it for just... That first one doesn't need to be very long because it's going to still be a lot of stain in it. That then goes in the jug because it's diluted stain at this point. You don't want to put diluted stain back in. So that'll go into a jug. And then just keep putting fresh water in. And when you put water in, put a lot... Not all the way to the top, but put a lot of warm water in so that there's it's a lot of difference between water and stain, and the stain will move more quickly by diffusion. But then you just put the lid on. He gave you lids, didn't he? Okay, well then don't put so much water in that it'll spill when you put it on the belly dancer. But that will this is a variable speed. That will just agitate it so you don't have to sit there and swirl it. Thing is, like I said, it takes many washes, but it'll go the fastest possible if instead of just keeping it up here for a long time and ignoring it, you keep it up here for a small amount of time and keep changing the water. Because you want to keep it a steep gradient for diffusion of that dye back out of the gel. You keep doing it. Basically, there's no magic number on how many times you have to do it or for how long. You do it until you can see bands in your gel, which you'll be able to see just when you're over here, but you'll see them better when you then carry that over to your light table and look at it. That's when you can see what I like things like I've drawn up here and maybe be able to tell that one of them is a possible criminal. Okay, anything else before I turn it off?